Well, you're all extremely welcome to the Center for the Study of Human Rights. As you know, we've been doing a large number of lectures this term, and we hope to do the same next term and into the indefinite future. I'm the director of the Center. Conor Geerty is my name, and I'm very pleased to see so many of you here at this particular evening function. I'm supposed to say at the end that there are drinks upstairs, and I'm supposed to say it in a way which is unenthusiastic and which doesn't lead a whole lot of you to come. But I was pointing out that in Ireland, if I were to say that, it would be a catastrophe because we'd all come and we'd drink the place dry. But I'm reliably informed that LSE students are refined and discreet, and that I can confidently tell you that there are drinks upstairs. I will tell you where the drinks are at the end of the lecture. My experience, again, drawn from my own cultural background, is that if you say in advance where the drinks are, there is nobody left to listen. So that's something to look forward to right at the end, where the drinks are. But we have lots to we have lots to look forward to before we get to the drinks. The topic of this evening's talks is Parliament and human rights in the United Kingdom 2 years on. We know that the Human Rights Act was passed in this country in 1998, but it came fully into force only on the 2nd of October 2000. So it's more or less 2 years since this measure took effect. And it has, of course, many ramifications, legal and political. As some of us will have been present to have heard David Fellman talk at the centre, at a lunchtime, about aspects of the legal side to the Human Rights Act. Tonight, we are concentrating on the interrelationship between Parliament and human rights, and looking at the extent to which, if at all, and I'm sure it has been, if at all, that relationship, the relationship between the idea of human rights and Parliament has been affected by the Human Rights Act. Now, we are extraordinarily fortunate in the LSE, in the way in which we are able to draw upon expertise which is both within the school and outside. And we have three speakers who I think are, in combination, better placed to take us through this topic than any other speakers one could kind of come up with. We start with Francesca Klug, who is, of course, here at the LSE, and who is somebody with probably a closer involvement in the enactment of the Human Rights Act than anybody else in the United Kingdom, with a tremendous perspective drawn from personal experience. And we're going to hear from Francesca first on the Act. And then we have the chair of the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which has been recently established with a brief to analyse human rights generally. And that is Jean Corston, and we're extremely pleased to have Jean here this evening. And then we end with David Fellman, Professor David Fellman, who is the legal something or other advisor to the Joint Committee on Human Rights. Sorry, David, I was looking for the right appellation there. And David will react to what he's heard and add his own dimension. So we have three different perspectives, and from that we should draw quite a knowledge, I think, of the extent to which the Human Rights Act has impacted on the human rights discourse in Parliament. But we are looking forward also to questions. This is the first time I've chaired a function in this peculiar room, and I do feel we are extremely high up, and it'll be involving me in quite a lot of strict pointing at you guys down there. But I do hope that despite the rather old-fashioned layout of the place, we can have a discussion. So we will have perhaps a few minutes for both interventions from the floor and questions before I ask the speakers briefly to sum up, if we have the time. Without further ado, therefore, I'd like to ask you to welcome our first speaker, Francesca Klug.
Thank you, Conor. Can you hear me? Yeah? Good. Thanks for that introduction, Conor, but there's one thing you failed to mention, and that is that I'm dangerous. At least, if we look back 12 years rather than two, that's what I and some of my colleagues at Liberty were once called for proposing that we could have a Bill of Rights in this country, where the Parliament would have a significant role in upholding rights as the courts. And the primary vehicle we proposed for this parliamentary role was the establishment of what we called a Human Rights Scrutiny Committee. Now, I'm going back now to 89, and up until then, in this country, the only parliamentary human rights committee was solely about what happened abroad, on the basis that, of course, in this country, human rights was something foreigners lacked, but we had in abundance. To begin at the beginning, or at least in the 1980s, one of the consequences of having years of one party in power, which, though elected on a minority of the popular vote, was able to tear up cherished freedoms and liberties at the stroke of a handbag, was to bring home to people the weakness of Parliament in our unwritten constitution. The main opposition to Margaret Thatcher's government at that time was the courts, not renowned for keeping the executive in check up to this point. But they too were deeply constrained in what they could do by legal and constitutional conventions that were virtually unique to this country. Some lawyers and civil libertarians began to look enviously at the rest of Europe and America with their bills of rights that allowed judges to strike down on constitutional legislation. Some American states even got rid of their poll taxes through this route, whereas we had to hold riotous demonstrations and watch the Conservative Party mount a coup against the then Prime Minister to achieve much the same end, although some would say our way was rather more fun. Now, it's true that the people did not march, I'm afraid, on Whitehall demanding a Bill of Rights, but the establishment of Charter 88 in 1988 caught the mini-zeitgeist of the time. This burgeoning pressure group pointed out that Parliament, like the proverbial emperor, had no clothes. In other words, when we said Parliament, we usually meant government acting through Parliament. Thousands of Charter 88 signatories called for reform of Parliament and a Bill of Rights to provide a bulwark against unaccountable government power. Now, ranged against this view was a fairly unholy alliance of politicians, academics, lawyers, and activists from across the political spectrum who feared that a Bill of Rights would actually increase our democratic deficit. Very reasonably, in my view, they were concerned that a Bill of Rights or incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights into UK law, which from this point of view amounted to much the same thing, would merely transfer legislative power from a nominally accountable, indirectly elected executive or government to a fully unaccountable, totally unelected judiciary. And Connor, I wonder if you think it would be fair to say that your views weren't a million miles from that at the time. The reason for holding this view? Well, human rights law is, of course, not like any other law. By its very nature, it is a set of broadly expressed values and standards which is intended to influence all other law and policy. Whoever's given the power to interpret how this higher law should be applied will, in practice, be lawmakers as much as law interpreters. Bill of Rights inevitably muddy powers rather than separate them. Now, here's where we at Liberty stepped in with our Human Rights Scrutiny Committee idea. Broadly speaking, we accepted the analysis of the latter group, the rejectionists, but the policy proposals of the former group, the incorporationists. Hence, you can kind of see why we were regarded with suspicion all round. In a document we rather pretentiously called A People's Charter, published in 1991, we proposed a Bill of Rights based on an incorporated European Convention on Human Rights, or ECHR, with knobs on, with the executive, legislature, and judiciary each given a role in its enforcement. Government will be given responsibility for signposting whether a new statute breached the Bill of Rights or not. The courts will be given the right to review legislation and executive acts for human rights violations for the first time in our constitutional history. And Parliament's role would be bolstered by this new Human Rights Scrutiny Committee. We suggested that this committee should probably be a joint committee of both houses to reduce interference in it through the party whips. We said it would be something comparable to the Joint Committee on Statutory Instruments. We gave it a central role in enforcing our proposed Bill of Rights through an extraordinarily labyrinth set of proposals, which I shudder to look at now, and I'm very glad to tell you that a People's Charter is now out of print. But unsurprisingly, no one took the overcomplex and ultimately unworkable proposals in a People's Charter too seriously. And this gave us the chance to work on the model some more, which we called the democratic entrenchment of a Bill of Rights. Now, if you sneak a look at Labour's 1992 manifesto, you will see reference to a democratically enforced Bill of Rights in it. Only weeks before the election, we managed to persuade the office of the then Labour leader, Neil Kinnock, but not the deputy leader, Roy Hattersley, that contrary to the then legal orthodoxy, it would be possible to introduce a Bill of Rights to curb unaccountable government power without fatally compromising our democratic system and without handing what would amount to legislative power to the judiciary. By now, New Zealand had just introduced its Bill of Rights, which, in contrast to the American, Canadian, or German models, for example, does not allow courts to strike down or overturn primary legislation, and which gives a significant role to parliamentary committees. Our idea that bills of rights do not inevitably have to involve judges having the last word on what the law is, and that they could include a significant role for parliament, was beginning to look a little less daft. Of course, Labour lost that election, but I don't think that can be entirely laid at the door of our dangerous proposal. When John Smith took over as leader and made his famous speech in favour of constitutional reform to Charter 88, I was dispatched to meet the new Shadow Home Secretary with a reversible name, Tony Blair. We worked, Tony Blair was the leader on this, on a model, he might not like to know it now, on the model for incorporating the European Convention on Human Rights into UK law, which would crucially still leave Parliament with the last word on what the law of the land should be. Labour were elected to power and the rest is history, as they say. But it's widely recognised that the model that was finally included in the Human Rights Act, and whose details I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to continue to work up with Jack Straw's office when he became Home Secretary after Labour got into power, it's widely recognised that the Human Rights Act can trace its pedigree to Liberty's original proposal for democratic entrenchment of a Bill of Rights. And why do I say this? Because it's essential to appreciate if we're going to look at the role and the successes or otherwise of the Joint Committee on Human Rights that Jean Corston chairs, it's central that we appreciate that the Human Rights Act approach was always, central to it was always going to be two things. One, the government statement when ministers introduce a bill or whether legislation is compatible or not with the Human Rights Act. And that's now Section 19 of the Human Rights Act. And for those of you who aren't anoraks about the Human Rights Act like me, remember that number, 19, because I'll refer to it again without keep telling you what it is. So central was always going to be Section 19, the government statement of compatibility, and the role of a joint scrutiny committee on human rights. After the Act came into force, there was some delay before the committee was set up, and people began to be concerned whether it ever would be set up. Without the committee, there was a real danger that Parliament's role, which was so central to the unique model for incorporation of the European Convention developed in the Human Rights Act, would in practice be usurped by the government's dominance of Parliament, back to those old emperor's clothes again. The committee was to be the vehicle to ensure that Parliament had its own independent and just as crucially informed voice, which would filter down to those backbenchers who had the will but not the means to scrutinise legislation for human rights compliance. However, I personally was always confident that the committee would ultimately be set up. Having worked closely with Jack Straw and other ministers over the years, I was sure that the vision behind the Human Rights Act was shared. The white paper, Bringing Rights Home, which accompanied the Human Rights Bill, was explicit. Parliament itself should play a leading role in protecting the rights which are at the heart of a parliamentary democracy, it said. Now, I will leave it to Jean and David to describe, if they will, how it was that the committee was able to infer their unusual for a select committee scrutiny role from the broad terms of reference the committee was given when it was finally established in January 2001 to simply consider matters relating to human rights in the UK. But the formidable reputation the committee already has, both inside and outside of Parliament, could undoubtedly not have been achieved without this unusual scrutiny role. And it could also, if I may say so, not have been achieved without the redoubtable chair and legal advisor, whom you'll hear from later today, and at the end of the evening, you can draw your own conclusions on that. Now, David Feldman asks in an article I recommend to anyone that is interested in this issue, it's in Public Law, Summer 2002, how can one assess the effectiveness of a process of scrutiny? Well, in preparing for this evening, I counted 7 indicators of success. First among these is indefatigability. 25 full reports and several special ones have been produced by the committee in less than 2 years, 18 months. They'll tell us exactly, there was an election in between and they had to wind down for a bit. It's an extraordinary record. The subjects range from animal health and homelessness to police reform. The committee even published its initial influential report on the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Bill, now known as ACSA, only 2 days after David Blunkett introduced the bill on the 12th of November 2001. I hope they're going to give us their secret to this speedy action tonight. The second index of success that I reckon is their influence on legislation. Now, I have to admit, they've had limited success on this. But nevertheless, it should be noted that some reports have led to small but significant changes in the final shape of legislation. And I'm thinking specifically here of the ACSA, the report on the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Bill, and also their report on the Employment Bill, which led to the government tabling amendments which addressed the Joint Committee's concern. Third index, it's influenced parliamentary debates. And of course, that was the whole purpose of this committee from the outset, to empower backbenchers to play their appropriate legislative role as backbenchers, distinct from the government of the day. And I'm thinking here of the Police Reform Bill, the Criminal Justice and Police Bill, the National Immigration and Asylum Bill. In all cases, the Joint Committee's reports has had a significant influence on those debates, not just through their direct reports, but because they very skillfully ferreted out the reasoning behind the government's Section 19, I warned you I wouldn't keep saying what it was, Section 19 declarations, and they passed on this reasoning to backbenchers, enabling the debate in Parliament to improve. And the committee's also scored important successes in persuading the government to expand the information it issues with its Section 19 statements generally, in developing good practice and guidelines for responding to the court's declaration of legislative incompatibility, and also incompatibility declarations by the European Court of Human Rights. It's influenced the work of other scrutiny committees, and most crucially, civil servants in the drafting stages of a bill. And anyone who's interested in that process, I recommend a report by Justice called Auditing for Rights, which I'm very pleased to tell you tonight, is freely available to anyone who wants a copy, a representative from Justice at the back of the room, and she will give out the report to anyone who's interested. And finally, they've also done that which, in fact, most select committees spend all their time doing, and that is they've conducted and are still in the process of conducting a significant inquiry into whether we need a human rights commission in this country, and if so, whether or not it should be tied to the new equalities commission that the government is proposing to set up. And although they haven't even reported fully on this inquiry, only an interim report has been published so far, they have managed to galvanise debate on this issue among civil society and relevant NGOs. Quite a track record, I think you'll all agree. But just in case you think I'm being far too generous in my praise, I would like, if I may, to throw down a gauntlet to Jean and David tonight, at the risk of being labelled dangerous once more. Reading both the committee reports and the articles on the methodology employed by the committee, I wonder, Jean and David, if you are being more reticent in your approach than you need to be. I'm not thinking so much of your conclusions here, but the way you reach them and what you think your appropriate role should be within the scheme of the Human Rights Act, as I understand it and as I've laid it out to you tonight. As Lord Leicester, a highly influential member of the committee, recently acknowledged, the Joint Committee scrutinises legislation for compatibility in a way similar to the approach adopted by the courts in assessing claims of human rights violations. And David, sorry to keep quoting you, has written that scrutiny usually has nothing to do with approving or disapproving of the purpose of a measure, and that the separation of powers establishes that only a court can make a final decision on whether a provision is compatible with the rights in the Human Rights Act or not. Now, this is not the place, I accept, to go into the full implications of these statements and the approach to scrutiny which follows from them, and perhaps we need another seminar to do so. But I'd like to leave David and Jean, and through them all of you, with a few questions which appear to me to flow from this approach, which hopefully they may have an opportunity to respond to in part tonight. And remember, this is all so new. It's so new to this country to have a committee like this. It's so new to this country to have a Bill of Rights at all. And it's actually pretty new on the international stage to have a Bill of Rights where Parliament is given such a central role. So there's a lot of original and new thinking going on here. But first, if the committee approaches its task in much the same way as the courts, what is its value-added purpose, I wonder? Is it just to save Parliament, or more honestly, government, from the embarrassment of being hauled over the coals by the courts for passing laws which breach the Human Rights Act? Looking at the Joint Committee's reports, it's difficult not to conclude that sometimes the committee is unnecessarily constraining itself. In its report on the Adoption and Children Bill, for example, you know the one I mean, the one that led to IDS's speech, Ian Duncombe Smith's speech, which said, "I'm the leader of the opposition, back me or get me out of here." In that report, the committee seemed to be tying itself up in knots to say, simply, that it supported the government's measures to end the prohibition on gay and unmarried couples adopting children because they enhanced the human rights of adults and children alike. The committee seemed to feel the need to rely on the minority opinion of a failed case at Strasbourg and a South African case to say what it should have been able to say in its own voice, in my view. After all, let's remember, the Human Rights Act has been described by ministers and academics alike as an act which encapsulates a dialogue approach to human rights compliance. And what's the point of a chat if one party to the chat is effectively second-guessing the other party all the time? Now, my second question is, if only the courts can determine compatibility, can determine whether legislation in particular is compatible with the Human Rights Act, then how do we get out of the catch-22 scenario where our judges frequently to defer to Parliament on the grounds that this is what is intended under the Human Rights Act, but the committee says only the courts can ultimately determine whether measures are compatible with the Human Rights Act or not? The vista develops of a question in permanent motion which never attracts a final answer. And this is compounded by the fact that on a large range of mainly social and economic issues, but also often questions of national security, the European Court of Human Rights itself also defers to the national authorities, and it doesn't specify between courts and Parliament on this, under its doctrine of a margin of appreciation to individual states. Now, it's obvious, of course, that judges are the arbiters of incompatibility in the case before them, based on the facts before them. But with the domestic and European courts both doffing their caps more deferentially than Paul Burrell, if Parliament, advised by the Joint Committee, does not see itself as charged with the responsibility of clearly and decisively determining compatibility of legislation with the Human Rights Act, then the danger is that it is the government who becomes the final arbiter of its own laws, and we're back to square one. And third and finally, if scrutiny for human rights compliance is in all circumstances about technical compliance, rather than approving or disapproving policy, then who, and on what basis, is to determine whether a policy is necessary and proportionate in a democratic society? And necessary and proportionate are the human rights buzzwords to determine whether a limitation on rights is acceptable or not under international human rights law. Now, I'm reminded here of an example from New Zealand, where the Attorney General, who has the Section 19 responsibility under their Bill of Rights, declared back in 1993 that the mandatory reporting of child abuse by certain professional workers could be a breach of the free speech provisions of the New Zealand Bill of Rights. The scrutinising committee, on the other hand, took the view that such a compulsion to report child abuse by social workers and teachers was in fact necessary and proportionate to save the lives of children, their fundamental right to life. Who is to decide which stance is right? In the end, there's no getting away, in my view, from the fact that reviews of necessity and proportionality, although conducted within a clearly articulated human rights framework, nevertheless invariably involve decisions about which policy is to be preferred. Now, at the risk of unmasking you, I believe that in practice the Joint Committee has shown itself prepared to interrogate the appropriateness of policies in human rights terms. It's taken evidence from NGOs and experts on the necessity and proportionality of the measures the government seeks to justify. But perhaps I'm being naive here about the political considerations involved. I wish you'd be more outspoken and forthright about this role and present yourself as more than a technical scrutineer of government measures against objective standards. In other words, I wish you'd find your own voice, particularly where the courts are mute. And I wish for this transparency, not just because it goes to the heart of the model of the Human Rights Act as I've outlined it, in which Parliament has a major role in determining human rights policy, remember, but because I believe it's central to our understanding of human rights. As the White Paper, which preceded the New Zealand Bill of Rights, famously concluded, in a great many cases, this is from their White Paper, in a great many cases where controversial issues arise for determination, there is no right human rights answer. And I would personally add, other than on hard issues like torture, detention and fair trial. What better body is there than Parliament, as distinct from government, to seek to provide the right, or rather the appropriate human rights answer, when there is no established or consensual human rights law on an issue, for example, on limitations on tobacco advertising, or indeed gay adoption? And what better body than the Joint Committee on Human Rights in the UK to ensure that Parliament fulfills this role in an informed way, as unfettered by government pressures as possible? To quote the Lord Chancellor, who said only last week in a speech at Durham University, the Human Rights Act represents a new, dynamic and cooperative endeavour between the executive, the judiciary and Parliament, one in which each works in its respective constitutional sphere. Far from aping the courts in their methods, this, in my view, gives the green light to the committee to develop its own voice in advising Parliament to do what it does best, develop policy and legislate, but to do so in conformity with human rights values and standards. You're already doing that. Now's the time to come out about it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Francesca. I guess if Francesca were here on her own, you'd be thinking, I really would like to hear the chair of the Joint Committee. And so here is the chair of the Joint Committee, Jean Crossley.
Well, thank you, Connor. It's very nice to be back at the LSE, where I have fond memories of my time here as a somewhat elderly law student, allowed to be let loose in the place by David Schiff, who was the admissions tutor at the time, to whom I owe thanks as giving me a marvellous opportunity, not knowing at that time, of course, that I would not spend much time as a barrister and become a Member of Parliament, which I've been for 10 years, and then chair this committee. I will say the only thing I recognise in here now is the doors. All the rest of it looks a lot smarter, so I don't know quite what's happened, because LSE looked rather tatty then and it looks really quite swish now. So something's been going on. The Human Rights Act actually is, I think probably Francesca would accept, is the one thing that the government didn't have to do. And actually it's one that probably has already, and will in the future, I'm confident, give it more problems than most bits of legislation it has or has passed or will pass in the future. Of course, the whole reason for it is that it's supposed to foster a compliance culture in government and in public bodies generally. And when I say public bodies, this also applies to any private body which is fulfilling a public function. And by and large, we haven't had too many problems with that, although I don't know whether we're still in discussion, David, with Railtrack as to whether they're a public body, but we thought they were and they thought they weren't. But you get the drift. Somebody who, anybody which fulfills a public function is also covered by the Act. And it's been under attack recently. Nobody in Parliament voted against it on third reading, but it's been constantly under attack in the Daily Telegraph, and just lately from the Conservative front bench and from the occupant of St James's Palace. But just recently, the committee went to India, Australia, and New Zealand in 14 days, in case any of you think it was fun, looking at whether we should have a human rights commission, because those three countries have similar parliamentary and legal systems to ours, and they all have human rights commissions. And the New Zealand Prime Minister, Helen Clark, said to me that human rights, if you're in government, human rights will always be an irritant, but it will always be a necessary irritant. And I think that's how I see this committee, really, that it's a kind of a necessary irritant. And I think it probably has been a bit more irritating than Francesca thinks, and I will try to show why. Earlier this year, David Blunkett came to a family function in my family and got up and said something about me. I gave up being his parliamentary private secretary in order to accept the Labour nomination as chair of this committee. And he said, she's a friend, but that friendship has been tested because she now chairs the Joint Committee on Human Rights, so she gives me more trouble than any Guardian leader. And I think that's how it should be, that I should give him more trouble than any Guardian leader. And human rights, politically, will at any one time, or because of a country's history, focus around particular subjects. In this country at the moment, if you talk about human rights, people often think about anti-terrorism, asylum, immigration. When we were in India, if you talk about human rights, they immediately talk about cross-border terrorism, what's going on in Kashmir, and the huge number of what they call extrajudicial deaths, because there is a lot of instances of people dying in custody in India. If you go to Australia, human rights is about Aboriginals. If you go to New Zealand, human rights, they tend to talk about Maori. So it can sometimes be a historical and sometimes a current political issue which brings human rights more into a political focus. And as Francesca said, the committee did get going finally in the last week of January 2001. And it's unusual in lots of different ways, most of them exemplified by Francesca, but the one which is often missed is that most select committees of the House of Commons, well, all select committees of the House of Commons, have a membership which reflects the balance of power in the chamber. So at the moment, you know, the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Defence Committee, the Work and Pensions Committee, all the rest of them have quite a large Labour majority. Because this is a joint committee, the government took the view that it would not be right for there to be a Labour majority on this committee, which in itself, if you're in government, is kind of asking for trouble. But I think they recognised that if this committee was to have the credibility which had been trailed for it, then there had to be equal numbers of government and opposition members. So we have 6 government members, 6 opposition, 6 are from the Lords, and 6 are from the Commons. And the chair has no casting vote. So as you can appreciate, even if any of the whips had tried to talk to me about decisions that we might want to make, it wouldn't make much difference given the membership of the committee. And indeed, we've tried very hard as a committee to look at issues without focusing exclusively on what the political focus is or what the government might want to deliver, and that's whether you're a government or an opposition member of the committee. And by and large, I think that's worked, and it's probably worked to a degree which some of my colleagues have been dismayed about. Francesca's referred to Section 19 of the Act, and of course the Section 19 statement is on the face of every bill. The sponsoring Secretary of State, if it's a government bill, has to say that in his or her opinion, the Act is compatible with the Human Rights Act 1998. Now, we felt straight away as a committee that that statement ought to be properly tested. That it was one thing for the government to say, oh yes, it's okay folks, this is entirely compliant, but somebody somewhere in Parliament should say that, should give a measured and dispassionate view, and that we were the only people who could do that. I think we were very conscious that the time that would take would mean that there wouldn't be a lot of time left for other things, and of course David Feldman will talk to you about the process, because David is the person who's at the forefront of this as our legal advisor and somebody with an international human rights reputation. Before I met him, someone did tell me that we were very lucky to have him as our legal advisor, and I think that's probably right. And to this day, I'm reminded occasionally by people of his sort of international stature as a human rights expert. Indeed, I sometimes think that our meetings are a bit like an evening with Dame Edna, except that I'm Madge. And the one thing which, in a way, Francesca referred to, which is the politics of it, is that when you're passing legislation, the first thing you ask is, the first thing you don't ask is this compliant with human rights? Because when you're looking at a Section 19 statement and you look at legislation, you ask yourself the lawyer's question, what is the mischief? What was it that made the government think that this particular bill or this particular clause was necessary at all or necessary at this time? And so that's where politics starts, from the mischief. And the mischief is where the politics starts and the human rights problems can arise, and we've seen that with terrorism, with asylum, with immigration, because the government gets caught between a domestic and international pressure for change or for action and the need to respect human rights. And so the question that we have to ask is, are the measures necessary and proportionate, and is there a pressing social need? And those are the questions which we address ourselves when we examine legislation for compliance with the Human Rights Act. But also, I think it's important to stress something which hasn't been mentioned, that our remit is not just the Human Rights Act 1998, the European Convention, but whether or not legislation is compliant with the international instruments to which the United Kingdom is bound in international law but not domestic law, things like the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, against racial hatred, Convention on the Rights of the Child, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and all the rest. So these clashes between the mischief and human rights can occur when you start from what's perceived to be a social need. I'll give an example from my own constituency last week. Bristol City Council is doing a listening exercise. They're holding meetings all over the city for people to come along and talk about what they see as pressing issues locally, to which they think the council should give attention. In my constituency, two issues have been right ahead of all the others. One is joyriding and motorbikes, sometimes in open spaces, sometimes on the street up until 4 o'clock in the morning, and the other is nuisance neighbours. So the question then is, for politicians, how do you protect the rights of the peaceful majority? And for people who are looking at human rights, legislation from a human rights angle is, yes, how do you protect the rights of the peaceful majority, but how do you also make sure that you protect the human rights of people who are actually really quite unpopular? Because human rights can be about people who are despised or vilified or not held in very high regard generally. But I detect a change in the way the decisions are being made by ministers. Sometimes this is sort of invisible, in that ministers will now approach me personally. You know, we troop through the lobby to vote. It takes 3/4 of an hour, but they'll come up and say, look, Jean, we're going to do so and so, and we're going to be publishing a bill, and there could be human rights implications, and it would be useful for me to know what kind of time scale that we could fit in with you, so that you can look at the bill and we don't have too many problems. So it is, penny is beginning to drop, and certainly, I think David will probably tell you, there have been several occasions now when departments have made direct approaches to him in response to our reports. And before the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act was even published, to which Francesca referred, and I am proud of the timescale in which we published that report, because we felt it very important that the House of Commons should have the opportunity to consider the bill alongside our report on second reading. David Blunkett did agree, and I've never said this in public before, but he did agree to meet a delegation of committee members on sort of a Chatham House basis, in that the meeting was entirely privileged, for us to talk through what he was going to propose in that legislation, and for us to talk about what we thought the human rights pitfalls would be. And that was certainly very useful for us. I also detect a change in that ministers tend now not just to ask, will this legislation get past the House of Lords and Strasbourg, but will it in this place get past the preliminary hurdle of the Joint Committee on Human Rights? And I think that is all to the good. Francesca said just now we take an essentially legalistic approach. It is true that some members of the committee do take an essentially legalistic approach, and that's because they're essentially lawyers. In a sense, it's a good thing. I mean, the six Commons members are politicians. The six Laws members aren't. And it's very important to remember this. One of them is an eminent human rights lawyer. One is the deputy chair of the Independent Television Commission. One is the head of a Cambridge college. One is a professor of politics. One is a retired QC. Can't remember what the other one is, but you get my drift. These are people who come to human rights, first of all, not in a representative way, because I hold my advice surgery every week. I know what the pressing social issues are that people bring to me, because they come and they either complain, or they commiserate, or they congratulate, or they nag, or whatever they do. But I'm lucky in that I have that weekly contact. Lords members don't. And it is true that sometimes, I don't necessarily mean present company, David, but it is true that sometimes my impression is that some members have taken almost orgasmic delight in dissecting particular cases, particularly the ones to which you referred, which doesn't necessarily set everybody on fire. But it wouldn't be right to say that the approach is just legalistic. I'll give one example. We were initially very hostile to the notion of child curfews. And one of the good things about the way in which we work is that generally, unless the government's bringing forward amendments very late in the process when we generally can't do anything, while a bill is going through Parliament, the committee writes through me to the sponsoring Secretary of State, raising concerns and saying, look, what was the mischief? Why is this in the bill? Because these are the problems. If you have this in the bill, these are the human rights problems you'll come up against. And back comes the answer. And we got a reply from the Home Office on child curfews. They gave us all the empirical evidence. And the whole committee read that and said, yeah, okay. So they accepted then the argument that the government was deploying in favour of this measure, which incidentally has never been used, on the basis of the sociological evidence that was produced by the Home Office. And we did say in our report how pleased we were to have had that. This has also been exemplified recently in our two reports on the adoption bill, because we did two, Francesca. There was the first one on the bill and then the second one on the amendments from the Lords that was specifically on the issues as to whether unmarried or gay people could adopt children, when our report was used extensively by the Lords and the Commons. And I have to admit that our reports are generally used more by the Lords than the Commons, and I suspect that's because the Lords is essentially a revising chamber. But during that adoption bill debate last week, that caused all the kerfuffle in the Conservative Party, there was repeated reference to, and people taking shelter behind the fact that we were saying that there could be serious breaches of human rights legislation if unmarried and gay people were prevented from adopting purely by means of their unmarried status or their sexuality. And we've in the draft mental health bill, and our report was published today, we had an approach early on from the minister. We've been in correspondence now for quite a while. But in this, you see, we know what the mischief is. The mischief is cases like Michael Stone, the man who murdered Megan Russell and one of her daughters and nearly murdered the other. That man had no identifiable mental illness, and yet lots of people knew he was dangerous, but he couldn't be sectioned under the Mental Health Act. So the mischief here is to protect us from people like Michael Stone. But in the doing of it, we've decided as a committee that the definition of mental health could include, accidentally, diabetics. that actually it could include people who are promiscuous. I mean, when I was a very small child, women who had affairs with American GIs and had babies were locked up as being moral degenerates. And fortunately, our mental health legislation has changed so that doesn't happen anymore. But we have signalled that that could happen unintentionally, because often legislation is about unintentional consequences if that were to happen. We're also looking at the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We're trying to look at one international instrument a year, because the government is examined on them. So we're trying, as part of the examination process, to look at them. And we've taken a lot of evidence on the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and at the same time are looking at whether we think there should be a Children Commissioner. And if you want any evidence of the spread of a human rights culture, I'd say a couple of things. One, the president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health appeared before us and said he'd never really thought about any of this until the Human Rights Act. And he was thinking about it particularly one day when he was sitting on the bed of a little boy of six who had come in for surgery. This boy was quite disabled, and all the adults who had anything to do with this child had decided that he should be operated on there and then. And he said he'd never asked this question before. He asked the child what he thought. And this six-year-old had, according to this professor, the most extraordinary insight into his own condition. And he managed to persuade this man that it would not be a good idea for him, this boy, particularly in relation to his education, for the operation to happen that year, that it should be postponed for a year. And he went back and he talked to the parents, and they eventually decided this child was right. So this is a whole thing about listening to children and children's human rights. I was talking recently to a GP who said, oh, I had to go to what I thought was going to be a really boring young principals talk, and it was about the Human Rights Act and issues of consent, and it was really interesting. I had never thought about those issues before. And Tim Brighouse, who has retired now as the chief education officer of Birmingham City Council, when he appeared before us, I asked him how the Human Rights Act had made a difference to his job, and he said it has made a difference because it's legitimised a set of values that might have been seen as idiosyncratic. This is what I now feel. If we have the Human Rights Act and all this other legislation, people can't say, wait a minute, this is an idiosyncratic, eccentric, romantic old fool. This is what everyone is saying, and they want for all the community. When the Sex Discrimination Act first came in, I remember vividly that people's first reaction was, what's the minimum we have to do not to fall foul of this law? And it took a long time before people began to think about a culture of equality. And if I'm honest, I think we probably still are at that first stage in this country with a lot of public bodies and with government departments. What is the minimum we have to do not to fall foul of this legislation? And there have been little lights along the way. You will no longer ever find on a patient's medical records, do not resuscitate. That used to happen, doesn't happen now. Human Rights Act, right to life. And human rights, to me, is not about any of these things, actually. A while back, when Alan Duncan, a Conservative MP, announced that he was gay, the person who calls herself, Theresa May, who calls herself the chairman of the Conservative Party, said, well, it was all right because the Conservative Party was tolerant. It is not about tolerance. It's about respect. And human rights are about respect. Gandhi once said, I intend to open the windows of my house to every religion, but I don't intend to be blown down by any of them. And it seems to me that after September the 11th and after what happened in Bali, and according to what the Prime Minister said last night, what might be happening here at some stage in the future, it seems to me that, and this in a way follows on from things that Francesca's written about, that we can't have in a multicultural society an emphasis on any particular religion or body of religious belief. There has to be a set of values that transcends religion, that transcends faith. And it seems to me that that set of values can only be human rights, which is why I think that the work we're doing as a committee in its small way is so important. Thank you.
very much, Jean, and precisely in the time as well. Fantastic. Our final speaker before our floor discussion, as already indicated by me, is David Feldman. David.
Hello, possums. I thought what I would do, since Jean has told you already something about the working practices of the committee, was to deal with a couple of general issues, but mainly to try to address the gauntlet that Francesca threw down directly. Because I think that the points that she's made are important ones and deserve a full response. Although not too full, Connor. This isn't going to be one of those occasions where you have to drag me away from the rostrum. Especially not if there's wine upstairs. The general picture, then. We get the bills. The committee receives notes on every bill. The notes identify as clearly as possible the particular provisions in bills in relation to which there appears to be a potential human rights incompatibility. And as Jean has said, it's not just about convention. It's about all rights under instruments to which the UK is bound in international law. Is that for me, or is it? if it is for me, I'm out. The committee considers the notes. If it thinks that the notes raise issues which are worth pursuing, then a letter is sent to the responsible minister asking for reply to a series of very specific questions about specific provisions in relation to specified rights. If necessary, the relevant case law is cited or reports of international monitoring bodies and so forth. For example, in relation to the Nationality, Immigration and Asylum Bill, there were 27 questions put to the minister before the committee reported for the first time. And one of the great things about the ability of the committee to succeed in producing reports in a reasonably timely and thorough way has been the very full cooperation that the committee has had from ministers and departments. This is not to be sneezed at. I mean, these responses that the committee gets from ministers are produced by bill teams who are also working extremely hard against a very tight schedule to move their bill through the various stages of the parliamentary legislative process. And they find time to provide the committee with extremely helpful and, as Jean has said, often fully documented and supported by reference to social scientific data and so on, answers to the committee's questions. The committee may disagree with the answers, they may disagree with the government's position ultimately, but without the willingness of departments to engage with the committee in this enterprise, then the committee would be left in a very difficult position when it came to expressing any worthwhile view about anything. Having got, this is an ideal scenario, assuming that the committee gets the government response on time, it then considers the response, looks at the bill again in the light of the response, and reports on the view it takes of the compatibility of the bill with human rights, having taken all the relevant material into account. But in the meantime, the committee will also have been asking for views from interested individuals who have expertise in the field, from NGOs with a particular interest in the field, and through its website from anyone else who wants to email the committee at jchr@parliament.uk with their views on the bill. Where evidence is received, all that evidence, not just the government response, but information and advice and views received from outside bodies, is published with the report on the relevant bill. What that means is that the committee's reports form not simply the view of the Committee on Compatibility, which, as Francesca has said, may sometimes not be expressed in the sort of direct and unequivocal terms that some people would like, but also a whole range of information about the background to the bill and its potential impact, which will in turn help, we hope, to inform debate in both houses and ultimately to inform the process of adjudication if these provisions end up being litigated either in the national courts or ultimately in Strasbourg. So when we come to the first question that Francesca put, which was, if the committee's approach is much the same as a court's approach to these issues, what is the point of the committee? Where is the value added by the committee? The answer is that the general approach of the committee is actually nothing like that of a court. It's completely different. The committee has power and exercises power to get answers to questions which go further than and deeper than anything that could be extracted from a party to litigation in the course of an application for judicial review or anything like that. And the committee also, through its policy of putting that information into the public domain, seeks to enhance the transparency of the legislative process and the transparency of the human rights assessments, as well as, and perhaps rather than, simply expressing or attempting to express a concluded view as to the compatibility of the legislation with the rights in question. Francesca refers to the somewhat convoluted report of the committee, the second report of the Committee on the Adoption and Children Bill Amendments. It is not an easy read, that report, and one member of the House of Lords said it was completely incomprehensible. Having read it, he simply had no idea what the committee was trying to say. This is someone who was a former cabinet minister and a highly experienced barrister, and he found it incomprehensible. I think that the committee was just being very careful about how it expressed itself, and being rightly careful about how it expressed itself. And this brings me to jumping for the moment over the second question that Francesca asked. I'll try to remember to come back to it in a second. But to Francesca's third question, which was, what happens to the political, necessarily political, elements of the decision about whether a measure is necessary and whether it's proportionate to a legitimate aim for the purpose of making these human rights assessments? What happens to that if the committee is unable or unwilling to address the merits of the policy on which the bill is based? The answer, I think, is that the committee has to be continuously aware of the limits of its constitutional function. It's too easy, I think, to say this is a simple human rights matter, it should have been obvious from the start that the refusal to countenance the adoption of children by gay and unmarried couples jointly would violate human rights. But that is simply not the case. When the committee reported for the first time on the bill in December 2001, it decided that the bill was compatible. And the bill at that stage had not been amended, as it was subsequently amended on a private member's amendment in the Commons, to allow adoption jointly by gay and unmarried couples jointly. The reason for saying that at that stage the bill was considered to be compatible with the rights under the convention, at least, was that until February of this year, when the European Court of Human Rights by a 4-3 majority decided Fretet against France, there was no decision from the court holding that that sort of provision engaged or fell within the ambit of the right to respect for private and family life under Article 8. And there were several decisions of the Commission holding that it didn't fall within the ambit of Article 8. And if it didn't fall within the ambit of Article 8, there was no room for the application of the anti-discrimination provision in Article 14, which of course always requires that there should be a substantive right affected. So it was simply not the case that it was a simple matter of looking at it and saying this is or is not a human rights violation. What was the committee doing? Well, the committee was taking, I think correctly, but then I would say that, wouldn't I, a view that it's not part of the committee's job when it's reviewing legislation, scrutinising legislation for human rights compatibility, it's no part of the committee's job to push forward at the boundaries of human rights interpretation beyond that which can be provided with a sound base in the international instruments and associated case law. That is a technical view, but on this matter, I'm completely convinced that it's the right approach. If the committee were to go beyond that, then it would lay itself open to a charge that its views on these matters were entirely subjective and so not entitled to be given any greater weight than anyone else's, or entirely driven by politics, and so not entitled to have their views given any greater weight than anyone who has different politics. Either way, it would seriously undermine the weight that would be attached to the committee's report. Or it would play into the hands of those, and there are all too many of them around, I regret to say some of them inside as well as outside Parliament, who simply regard the whole human rights agenda as a sort of wishy-washy, we don't like that, so it must be a breach of human rights, we've got to be nice to each other sort of agenda, which lacks rigour, lacks any sort of basis for a compelling argument in justification of the conclusion. And indeed, even though the committee in its report on the Adoption and Children Bill amendments was very careful to ground its arguments in the case law, the committee was still accused of that, particularly in debate in the House of Lords. There is a risk that if the committee goes in for that sort of thing too often, it will be unable to perform its functions. And what are its functions? Well, I think its functions are, first and foremost, to advise both houses of Parliament, to make sure that Parliament, which under the Human Rights Act, remember, is given this immense and extraordinary power, still to continue to legislate incompatibly with convention rights. That is from the outsider's point of view anyway, an immense and extraordinary power. I mean, the fact that we're so used to the notion of parliamentary sovereignty in this peculiar UK sense tends to obscure that. But it is a most extraordinary power to say, yes, we accept that there are these human rights, but the legislature should be entitled to legislate incompatibly with them. The problem that the committee is designed to deal with is that if Parliament is going to have that power, it needs a means of establishing, of understanding what the human rights implications are of what it intends to do. The committee's reports are first and foremost intended to guide Parliament. Parliament can go on then and do what it likes, but it ought to do that in the light of an understanding of the implications of what it's doing. It's not simply a matter of politics. Politics are important, but it goes beyond that, because human rights have to be more than politics, and to some extent outside politics, if they're not simply going to be absorbed within political debate. So the first job is to advise the two houses, to inform the two houses. The second job is to make the government's reasoning on human rights issues more transparent. And the third job, incidentally, but I think in some ways most importantly of all, is through its questioning of departments, its challenging of departments, to help to spread the culture of human rights in this intensely searching and rigorous form through departments that are responsible for legislation. And that, I think, with some successes, admittedly some failures, but on the whole, I think, given that the committee has only been actually operating for about 15 months, I think the committee has not done a bad job. And so we come to Francesca's last question. If only courts can determine compatibility, are we not simply tossing the question of compatibility backwards and forwards between the courts and Parliament, each of whom is deferring to the other? And the answer, I think, is no. Ultimately, that has to be a question for courts. I don't see any alternative to that. That's what is recognised in the Act as a result of the availability of a declaration of incompatibility, and it's an essential part of the adjudication that courts have to do. Parliament doesn't adjudicate. The essential thing for Parliament is to decide what it wants to do, how it's going to balance for itself these different elements, the core of the right, the pressing social need, and all that is wrapped up in that. That's a judgment Parliament can make. The committee can help by teasing out the various elements in that process, but neither Parliament nor the committee, which after all is a creature of Parliament, has the constitutional authority to determine questions of compatibility, and it seems to me to be absolutely right that the committee should be constantly aware that that is not its role. Its role is to assist in legislation, not to attempt to adjudicate. Can I finally say that it's been a tremendous pleasure for me and a very exciting experience for me over the last 2 years or so to be involved with the birth and development of the committee. We really are, as Francesca said, making it up as we go along still. We're working out our practices, and occasions like this are extremely helpful for us in getting feedback on what people think we are doing. But if I can simply say this, the committee would have been able to do nothing in the last 2 years had it not been for the inspired and inspiring chairmanship of Jean Causton, who has held this committee together. It's not something that's easy to do. They are, apart from...
Go on, say it.
Well, they are very strong-minded individuals on this committee. Some of them, as Jean said, driven by the party political agenda, but a lot of them not. The tendency they have would be, I think, to run off in different directions on every conceivable issue. And the fact that, we've produced as many reports as we have and got them agreed, I think, in every case without a vote, is a tribute to the determination, vision and skill with which Jean has chaired it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. It sounds like they're the Madge and you're a combined Dame Edna, I think. But the speakers have been fantastically disciplined, folks. Not one of them straying more than a minute and a half past their 20 minutes. So I would crave from you the same discipline. You may know the centre is developing certain kind of assumptions about interventions. One is that the first thing you say, please, and I'm hoping there are some, is who you are. You might be a student, you might be from outside, please just say where you're from. And you can make an observation or you can ask a specific question. It doesn't have to be a question, it could be an observation. And we're going to ask the speakers briefly to sum up just before seven. So we may take a number of questions, we may not. It depends rather on their nature. But I would like some. So do we have any takers? We have a lady in the front and we have a gentleman there. So I'll take these two to start, please. Can we, who's this question directed to?
Question,
to whom? I'm sorry.
Oh, well, it was Jean Causton. Fine. So, what exactly meant when Jean Causton said that the same sentence as promiscuity and diabetes, because that would certainly make a hell of a lot of people vulnerable to some kind of violation within the courts, potentially. And my experience criminalised for infecting others is that in fact most of them are more terrified of infecting and therefore take actions not to, rather than the opposite way around. But HIV positive people, of course, carry the virus, so they are seen as the aggressor. Now, I mean, it's a huge issue, but I think it's a very important one when we're talking about this virus. For me,
each and every person has a responsibility in the area of sex and sexuality, and people with HIV are neither 60% responsible and 40% responsible if you're negative, so I'd like some clarification, I suppose, about what exactly that meant, because surely there are people out there who may have been diagnosed with mental illness, and there'll be a lot of people who are vulnerable, sure, and I get that. But I'm not sure exactly what you meant by, certainly people with diabetes, I have no idea about. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll perhaps take this gentleman. We won't come to Jean straight away, Jean, if that's all right. And sir, you had your hand up?
I'm an LSE alumnus from some years before Jean, when the invention of carpets wasn't known in LSE, but be that as it may.
Yes.
I'm not a lawyer, but I am a lay magistrate. And my concern, addressed to Jean, and the concern of some of my colleagues is the attitude of some ministers seeking to get around Article 6, the independent and impartial tribunals. I won't go into detail. I refer to a case in Scotland where Scottish ministers in the planning application were told by the Court of Session that their use of the case involving the case at the European Court of Human Rights, the case where the decision came in Bryant versus the UK, that if the initial tribunal was not independent and impartial, it could be rectified by the appeal tribunal. The Scottish court threw it out. Similar case in England and Wales in 2000, just after the Act came in. And by the way, magistrates very much welcomed the Act. We had to do a lot of training, but the fact that we have to give reasons for our decisions has been very helpful indeed. Going back to the point I'm making, a case in England and Wales where the then Secretary of State sought to set up a planning tribunal, which the courts told him in summary, when the judges summarised their decision, was that it was not independent and impartial. You cannot be policy maker and decision taker. And now in the Queen's speech tomorrow, and it's in Parliament in the House of Lords in 2 weeks' time on the 22nd, is the reform of licensing. Long, long, long overdue. But what's been proposed there is that appeals should go from the Crown Court down to the Magistrates' Court, fine, but the initial jurisdiction should go from the Magistrates' Court to the local authorities, which ministers have accepted from us is not an independent and impartial tribunal, but again can be rectified by the appeal procedure. What the courts will decide if and when it comes to court, I don't know. But it is shaking our confidence and other people's confidence to see ministers looking for ways round Article 6 of the Act. We welcome your comments.
Thank you. I wonder whether we might take Jean very briefly, or we'll take a third perhaps, Jean?
Yeah.
Sir.
Okay. See, I'm a diabetic physician from Gandhi's India, and I sincerely don't know who I am in this country, but I'm a human being. I don't know whether I enjoy human rights or not. Yeah. When these acts were incorporated into your legislation 2 years ago, newspapers like Guardian, in fact, they cautioned Jack, oh, Jack, this is going to flood your courtrooms. I'm sure that you would have got the statistics there. But coming to the reality, madam, so you expect us, I'm sure that there will be overseas students here, you expect us to flood your education institution only to pay twice what a British student is expected to pay, even to learn human rights from you, sir, or Connor, the Irishman, Connor Gay.
No, I don't caricature me by reference to my nationality.
Yeah, we the Indians have we share so much with you, right. The colonial culture, okay? Yeah. Then, hospitals, okay? Schools first, okay? Hospitals. But for the overseas workforce, you know what will happen to your third world system will collapse. You offer us only limited registration, type 2 training, tribal positions. So even here, you are offering us only a flavor of human rights. How can you imagine, how can you delude that you are going to feed us? I'm in India, at Zimbabwe, the human rights. So we don't accept that. Okay, come here, we'll give you only type 2 human. You can formulate a type 2 human rights. Or come out vigorously. Okay, we will include you, this is a real multilateral society. If you really want to test my theory, one of you come with me to the British Medical Association, you will see what is human rights, what sort of human rights I enjoy. One of you come with me to General Medical Council, you will see what is happening. And one of you come to, what else is there? Manchester Royal Infirmary, which even before I developed schizophrenia, they predicted. So what you for me, this is illusion, this isn't reality.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I think that's three more or less directed at Jean, actually. So did you want to respond very, very briefly, Jean? But I do want to keep time for some further interventions from the floor and then finish around seven, so.
Right. The first point, for me to amplify the comments I was making about the new definitions in the mental health bill, the draft mental health bill, because it's important to remember this is only in draft. It's a very important departure and one that I entirely applaud that legislation's now published in draft on occasion, because it means we have time to look at unintended consequences. What we actually said was, can't find it now, the proposed definition of mental disorder appears to us to be over-inclusive, potentially, covering a number of conditions which would not normally be characterised as mental disorders, and allowing health professionals to act as guardians of morality as well as health. That was the flavour that we took from the wording in the draft bill, that we felt that the provision, the drafting was too wide. I was using examples when I was talking about diabetes and promiscuity, because the way the provision was drafted could, I'm not saying it would, it could include those. So what we're calling on the government to do is to tighten up the drafting of that. At least we're suggesting that part of the bill could be, the drafting could be tightened up. As to the licensing legislation, I'm afraid that at this stage I can't really help you where this is going to be one of the first things we're going to be looking at. David may want to comment, actually, when it comes to the changes in appeal rights, because this is something that I know about. And with regard to human rights and medical care, then this is obviously a huge issue. We, as a committee, we are charged with the responsibility of looking at any human rights issue in the United Kingdom, excluding individual cases. And one of the advantages of going to India recently is that we were able to learn from India about the benefits of a human rights commission. Now, we haven't committed ourselves as a committee, but it seems as to whether we think there should be a human rights commission. But it was quite clear to us from talking to people in the human rights commissions in India, in the Human Rights Equal Opportunities Commission in Australia, and the Human Rights Commission in New Zealand, that there are several groups and categories of people, including people who are either having medical treatment or are detained for medical treatment, who could well benefit. As to going around particular hospitals with you, I mean, I regret that I don't have the time, but I do accept the point that you're making.
Thank you. Thank you. One of the advantages, sir.
Why do you expect me to get
sir.
I don't know whether she acts here. She has got the point up. She is not willing. If you are not willing to act, you act right. Fine. Leave it.
Can we take this up? Later. Can we talk up at the reception? No, we're not, sir. Can I take some people who have not spoken, please? This can carry on forward. Madam, you had a question.
Thank you. Viorica Bergman was a past member of Women's National Commission. Something I'm not quite clear about with your commission, are you looking at an existing position for people as a whole or only on new legislation? Now, in the area of the aged, where the question of whether they may or may not have appropriate treatment, are you too old for a particular treatment, are you going to get the drugs which are most appropriate to you, is it not a question of human rights of that person, and also the right of a person who is at work to work in a safe area. The government is not going to do anything about possible killing. Now, what is the position there? Are you going to take this forward or only purely on proposed legislation?
Thank you. And I think we might take another question. Yeah. Sir, and there's a microphone coming to you. There are two microphones coming to you.
Thank you. My name is Andy Nupchedi. I currently work in the field of clinical negligence, and I'm a registered part-time student doing LLM in human rights here. I've got a question for Jean Colson regarding the report that you were just flagging up regarding the proposals on the mental health bill, the government proposal. I've got a question on the dangerous people, the classification of dangerous people. Not all dangerous people suffer from mental illness. So if all dangerous people would be put under mental health or mental illness, how do you suggest that doctors should treat those people? Because right now, as the current law stands, doctors have a legal duty as well as a professional and ethical duty to provide medical treatment that benefit patients. If those people do not actually have a medical condition or any sort of mental illness, what would you suggest that doctors should do to these people? Would it not be better for these people to be treated under the criminal justice system rather than under the mental health law?
Thank you. I'll take one more question from the top. A very brief two questions, and then we might have to move to summing up. Yes, please.
Helena Cook from the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. I'd just like to ask Francesca what you think the current political prognosis is for actually getting a human rights commission, and if it were to come into effect, what changes that would require to the remit of the committee to ensure that there wasn't any duplication.
Thank you. We've got one, and we've had somebody put her hand up in the most persuasive manner. So we'll take these two. Very quickly, if you would, sir.
For Professor Feldman.
And you can remind us briefly who you are.
George Letter from UCL. I take it that there are two understandings of the role of the committee. The first one is to report on the incompatibility in terms of what the case law has been already. The second understanding is to report on whether there's a compatibility, all things considered. Now, the distinction is clear here. There might be some violation, even though there is no case law, or even though courts have made a mistake about whether there's violation. The role of the committee should be to consider the issue in substance. Now, the reason you gave why it should not be in substance is that you could be accused of subjectivity. Now, I take it that human rights are embodied in the institutionally precisely because they're not subjective. So if there's a right answer in what counts as a violation, then the role of the committee should be to regard the substance and not the past case law.
Thank you, and thank you for the economy with which you expressed that. We'll keep it for the summing up. And we have a lady at the back who's about to speak.
Thank you. My name is Blanca Rodriguez. I'm a lecturer of constitutional law in Spain. I'm visiting President of the LSE. So I tend to contemplate the whole issue from outside. And I know I've asked David Feldman this question before, but it seems to me that too much attention is being concentrated, is being paid to the role of the committee. And important though it is, the real questions of human rights come up in individual cases. It is very difficult to foresee in advance what the problems are going to be when legislation is applied. So it seems to me that the real problem for parliamentary sovereignty and in the application of human rights is going to come when laws are actually being applied. So what is the role of the judiciary in the whole thing? I know they are supposed to decide in the last instance whether a law complies with the Human Rights Act or not, but how are the judiciary being trained in the culture of human rights? Because it is them who are going to have the last word after all, and who are going to challenge the division of power. And I tend to see the role of the committee as temporary rather than so relevant in the long run. Thank you.
I think what we'll now do is we'll take the speakers in reverse order in which they spoke first and ask whether they have any comments to make or answers to specific questions by way of summing up this evening's talks. I think that puts you, David, if you wanted to speak.
I was asked two questions directly. One was about the compatibility incompatibility compared with compatibility, all things considered. And I think the suggestion was that the committee ought to be trying to push on the human rights interpretation in areas where there's no case law. Well, of course, in areas where there's no case law, the committee does exactly that, and not only where there's no case law. The committee has been prepared to say that in certain situations it thinks that the case law there is would not be followed. Coming back to the Adoption and Children Bill report, the committee expressly said that it thought that the majority decision in Frete on one of the two points in issue would, in our view, not be followed, and it was probably the most categorical statement the committee has made on the question of law. The interesting thing is that the pressure to do that came not just from the lawyers on the committee. Most of it came from the non-lawyers. So I don't think that there is this dichotomy that perhaps I over-enthusiastically suggested between sticking to the letter of the law and being prepared to take account of the fact that human rights are necessarily and properly interpreted in a dynamic way. But what I think I would stand by is the proposition that one has to start from the texts and the authoritative material and then think about how far that takes you, and where it doesn't take you to a full answer, you expand it. The other question, which I think was directed to me, was about individual cases and the role of the judiciary. And the position there is the judiciary had a reasonably thorough training program before the Act came into effect. It was certainly a fuller training program than I understand had been offered in any other Council of Europe country before human rights legislation had taken effect in those countries. And it was participated in by judges, among others, judges from the European Court of Human Rights. I think it is absolutely right to say that the real impact is in individual cases, but not, I think, necessarily in individual cases which get to court. And I think not only in individual cases, I think systems within public authorities are equally important. And concentrating on what happens in court won't get you the whole way towards understanding the importance and impact either of human rights generally or the Human Rights Act in particular. I'll leave my colleagues to answer other questions.
Okay, I was asked two specific things. We do only look at new legislation, yes. And to be honest with you, doing that is probably as much as, if not more than the committee can cope with sometimes, because as I has been said, we've produced 25 reports this year. The availability of drugs and the question of cost and postcode lottery, as it's called, is now dealt with by the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which publishes very regular reports now on drugs and the degree to which they feel that they should be prescribed. As to elderly people, there's one issue that we do want to look at after we've done our Human Rights Commission inquiry, and that is the outcome really of a case some time ago where the courts held that a person who is resident in a Leonard Cheshire home wasn't covered by the Human Rights Act because the Leonard Cheshire Foundation wasn't a public authority, which means that anybody in a local authority residential or nursing home is covered by the Human Rights Act, but somebody who's in a nursing home which is run by a body which is not a local authority is probably not covered. So that is one issue we want to return to. As for the Mental Health Bill, there is no definition in the Mental Health Bill of a dangerous person or dangerous people. And part of the reason for this legislation is not just, I think, the protection of the public from people who are known by professionals to be dangerous but not haven't fallen under the definition in the previous 1983 mental health legislation, is because a lot of people do end up in prison when they ought really to be treated in hospital. And I give you one very graphic and unpleasant illustration. I've probably visited more prisons than anybody I know. As a Member of Parliament, I'm interested, but also as a previous member of the Home Affairs Select Committee when we did an investigation into the management of prisons. And I once went to a women's prison, and there was a woman inmate who was very seriously mentally ill and shouldn't have been there at all. She was a casualty of the care in the community policy. And one, she had had a very severe abdominal operation a few years before. And one night she took off her bra. She used the hooks from the bra and she opened up her incision. And you know, the contents of her abdomen were falling out of this incision. Now, you can only imagine the effect on prisoners on either side of her cell and of the staff who had to deal with her, because they weren't trained mental health professionals, they're prison officers. People like that should not be in prison. And, you know, with any luck, if we have a decent mental health body of legislation, people like that will be treated in hospital and not be condemned to prison. That's something that I saw 6 years ago, which I will never forget. And I heard about 6 years ago, I'll never forget.
Thank you, Jean. And finally, but with a reminder that we can also respond to previous speakers from the platform, Francesca too. Can we pick things up, unless you want, I don't want to necessarily get into that. Can we do the, are you going up for a drink? Yeah, can we follow it up there? Thank you very much. It's always one of my students, it's easier to manage like that. Francesca.
Yes, Conor kindly said that about me, being able to respond to other speakers from the platform, because he knows that I always like to have the last word. I always need to go first before. This was a first for me to go first, knowing David could answer everything I say and would I have a chance to answer back. But first of all, let me just very briefly respond to the question about the Human Rights Commission, which is a very big question. And to some extent, there are people on the platform who are better placed to respond about how this is viewed politically than I am. But let me just say this. Sources close to the Prime Minister, I think that's the phrase, said to me recently, look, if we're trying to reduce the number of quangos, that is, by amalgamating the current equality bodies, why on earth would we set up a new one called the Human Rights Commission? And I think that just about sums it up. However, that doesn't mean all is lost for those of us who think that what is missing from the original vision of the Human Rights Act is a body to explain to the people at large and interpret court decisions what a human rights culture would look like. For those of us who think we need that body and that it's indispensable, there is an opportunity, precisely because the government is now looking at developing this new equalities commission, which isn't actually just about collapsing the different equalities bodies into each other and saving time and money. It is actually about creating a new body which is more holistic in its outlook. But of course it has all sorts of gaps, because the equalities bodies are simply responsible for specific pieces of legislation that determine its standing order. So for example, new legislation on age discrimination and sexual orientation discrimination is effectively only about sexual orientation and age and employment rights. The Human Rights Act values would fill the gaps of those areas, and therefore I actually think there's now a chance to get a Human Rights Commission as part of an equalities body, an Equalities and Human Rights Commission, an opportunity that we've actually not had before. It has become a political reality, but it's about politicians and in particular ministers hearing that people out there want that to happen, and I think if they did and they listened to the arguments, we've all to play for on that. But just using the chance now to have the last word to respond to a couple of things that David said. What I think, for those of you perhaps who are not so familiar with some of these debates about the Human Rights Act and the Human Rights Commission, what I think you've been witnessing is actually two different, slightly different perspectives on what human rights are all about. Now, if I could sum up those perspectives, David would say, I'm wrong and he's right. And I would say, well, there are two different ways of looking at this. Because there is one view that there is a human rights body of case law which is known and can be discovered. And that's a perfectly legitimate, obviously, and the majority view and the more common view. But there is another view, and I fully accept that I put myself in this camp, which says that human rights are a set of values which inform law. And they're constantly evolving. And to understand those values and how they may be applied, you do not necessarily have to be a judge. Now, obviously, there are constitutional responsibilities in this country as in any other. And it's absolutely true to say, as I said earlier, that the courts are the ultimate arbiters in the case before them, on the facts before them. But I beg to differ with David in terms of the model and the vision behind the Human Rights Act. In that vision, Parliament has the final say on what whether legislation complies with the Human Rights Act or not. The way David would express it is that Parliament is entitled to legislate against the Human Rights Act. Well, that's strictly speaking true, but that's not how I would sum up the vision behind the Human Rights Act. For me, it was about saying, let politicians determine this, not the government, but politicians. That's why we need this committee, to give politicians the vehicle to do this. And why? Because for two reasons. One, because as I said at the very beginning, it's widely recognised that human rights law is not like all other law. It muddies the separations of powers rather than enhances it. So the fact is that the courts, when they're doing their exercise of determining what is compatible and what is not, and looking at necessity and proportionality, they're effectively legislating. Are they going to have the final word on that legislation? Under some constitutions, such as South Africa and America, there's a general view that they should. And there's all sorts of reasons why. For example, the enormous democratic deficit, the total absence of democracy that existed in those countries before their bills of rights were enacted. But here we didn't have a total crisis of democracy. We had gaps in it. We had the courts not being allowed at all to look at legislation at all, to review it whatsoever. And we had the courts being stymied in their capacity to see whether discretion is exercised compatibly with human rights values. Now the courts have been given that power, but we said we do not want them ultimately to legislate. That remains with Parliament. And for that interesting speaker who said the really important point about human rights is what happens in the courts, I think that is the case in some administrations. I'm not convinced here, because most of us will never go into a court in our lifetime, but all of us are affected by legislation. And I decided where I stood on this when, in looking at this model, Canada, just at that very moment in time, hit a crisis with its Charter of Rights, because the women's movement that had campaigned for that charter, and in fact had campaigned for judges to be able to overturn acts of Parliament, of their Parliament, that breached their charter, and campaigned very strongly for that, got a big shock when the Canadian Supreme Court overturned the Rape Shield legislation, the legislation which said that that rape victims in court should not be questioned on their sexual history. When the courts overturned that, the problem was not whether that was the right or wrong decision, but the shock those women got that they couldn't lobby to change it again. And this was something they'd fought for. So when we came to look at this model, we looked at experiences like this and we said, no, we've got the European Court of Human Rights to tell us when we go completely wrong, within the boundaries of the kinds of decisions that Parliament can make on social issues, on political issues, on philosophical issues, and even on issues like Rape Shield. Let Parliament have the final word. Now, our courts have overturned our Rape Shield. That's exactly what's happened here, is what happened in Canada. But the difference is, Parliament can still reenact that legislation if it so chooses. It's a complicated vision of human rights, but in my view, the difference between David and I is not who's right or who's wrong, but how you understand human rights and what works for which democratic and constitutional system.
Thank you. I've got this feeling that I've got this feeling we're going to have a fairly lively drinks party. There is a talk. Hina Jilani is coming here on the 10th of December. That's our next scheduled event. There's a talk, there's drinks now in, it's called the Robinson Room. It's on the third floor of the old building. I think we're in the old building. Yeah. You're all very welcome, I say enthusiastically. But mainly, I say with enthusiasm, thanks to our three speakers for a superb variety of contributions and excellent answers to questions. Thank you so much.